talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
As one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we'll be investigating the history of Ireland's non-political executions from the 18th century right up to the 20th, starting with the story of Annie Walsh, the only woman who was executed in independent Ireland 100 years ago. Tonight, we'll be bringing you some of history's darkest moments. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. This August marks the centenary of the execution of Annie Walsh, the only woman to be hanged in independent Ireland. Her story is the focus of an experimental short film, The Girl from Fenimore by Matthew Rockett, but it's just one piece of a much larger history, the often overlooked narrative of non-political executions in Ireland. From agrarian rebels to local executions at the very site of the crime, the landscape of Ireland is filled with such stories of justice and indeed injustice dispensed in times past. And in tonight's show, we're going to delve into this forgotten history and the grim legacy of gallows across the country. And a warning for our listeners that some of the cases discussed here are quite gruesome. Well, we have a brilliant panel of experts discuss this topic with us tonight. Professor Kevin Rockett is Professor Emeritus of Film Studies at Trinity College Dublin and is a film historian, writer and scholar. Dr. Lindsay Black is Associate Professor in the School of Law and Criminology at Maynooth University and is an expert on women and punishment, the death penalty and historical and post-colonial crime and punishment. She's a member of the Council of the Irish Legal History Society and the author of Gender and Punishment in Ireland, Women, Murder and the Death Penalty. Professor James Kelly is Professor of Irish History at DCU and has written extensively on Irish history, including editing the collection of essays Death and Dying in Ireland, Britain and Europe, and he's contributed to the book A Global History of Executions and the Criminal Corpse. And we're also delighted to be joined by Matthew Rockett, the writer, director, composer and producer of The Girl from Fenimore, and this film is his debut short. Well, you're all very welcome. And Matthew, I might begin with you. What inspired you to make this short film about the story of Annie Walsh?
Okay, sure. So this all started in Bulgaria around a year ago. I was studying on my master's in film and television composing for media. And I was tasked with creating a score for a film project. And maybe it was got to do with being away from home and wanting to bring some sort of Irish identity to the table. But I wanted to create something that had some sort of Irish flavour. And it just really intrigued me, a little nugget of history that maybe wasn't well known. So I wanted to kind of explore that.
And tell us about Annie Walsh, because she is a fascinating figure, and as the only woman to be executed in independent Ireland, she really has this kind of central part in the story.
Yeah, exactly. And she, you know, that was really the hook for me. And obviously there were women before and a little bit after that had also, you know, she does have the headline as the only woman, and in a way she was. I think her story was just really intriguing to me. She was married to a man much older than her. He was 60, she was 31 at the time of his murder. So she ended up killing her husband with the help of the husband's nephew, Michael Talbot. And they actually were having an affair as well. And their alibi went a little bit off, and they ended up both kind of throwing each other under the bus, creating an execution for both of them. So,
and was she having an affair with her
nephew? Husband's nephew, yes. Some of the records, yes, imply that. And yes, it was said that she was having an affair, and he was perhaps the one who was the main instigator for the death, and they obviously were going to get the insurance money from the husband's death as well. But there was sort of maybe she was the actual instigator. She wanted to, you know, given that she was slightly older, she would have been 31 and the nephew would have been 23 at the time. So even that kind of power dynamic was kind of an interesting one too.
And did she expect to be executed? Did she think it would be commuted? Did she think there'd be a reprieve maybe at the end?
Well, I think initially I thought she was going to be getting away with it. They had some sort of alibi that it was an intruder that had come in the middle of the night, had tried to steal from them and inadvertently kill the husband. They were both, both herself and the nephew were both interrogated, and obviously their stories didn't really match up. I think Annie sort of was the first one to break it off from Michael and kind of blame him for everything. Once she sort of wanted to just get herself out of it, and then obviously he blamed her. So,
Lindsay, it is an extraordinary case, and how significant is it in the story of, I suppose, these non-political executions when we're looking at it in terms of, first of all, in terms of independent Ireland?
It is. It's absolutely extraordinary, and not for anything really relating to the facts of the case, because it's really mundane, but it becomes, as you're saying, headline, because a woman, for example, just taking the case of a woman, hasn't been executed since 1903. And then there are no women executed after her. So she attains this kind of mythic quality as the only woman executed in independent Ireland. And she's also executed at a time, she's executed in the mid-1920s, where you're seeing the kind of heaviest and most intense number of executions taking place. There is, post-independence, a bit of a spike in the numbers of kind of non-political executions. And she's part of that. There's more death sentences, there's more executions. And then after the 20s, there's a real kind of tailing off until you get to World War II. But for her, I think one of the reasons, and we can speculate why she ended up being executed, I think one of the reasons is that it's very much the context of violence. It's post-revolutionary violence period. It's just kind of in the ether. So there is a greater level of tolerance for violence. That's, there are more executions. People are used to it. I think the country is kind of bloodied. So I think if you'd given her another couple of years and this case had come up, I think she would have been reprieved. I think her gender would have done the work that it did for all the women coming afterwards and for many of the women coming before. But her timing was just very unfortunate for her, because, as Matthew was saying, she was the dominant party, so it was hard for her to get away with it on those grounds. But there were cases after, cases that came quite quickly after as well, which were, you know, hard to distinguish on the facts from Annie Walsh's case, and they were all reprieved. But she just happens to come in the 1920s at a point at which the country has been very much bloodied by war, and there's a greater tolerance of violence and a greater need to kind of clamp down on the disorder of the country.
Because the death penalty for common murder, that's only removed from the statute book in 1964. And as you say, there are people who are found, women who are found guilty and sentenced to death in the lead up to that. But at the last minute, you see them being reprieved.
Yeah, I mean, apart from Annie Walsh, and unhelpfully, there's another Annie Walsh case, which is nearly a carbon copy, that occurs in 1929, but she gets reprieved. So, but apart from that first Annie Walsh, every single woman largely benefits from the fact that she is a woman. And I think one of the things that happens after Annie Walsh is that there's almost a silent kind of resolution made that won't happen again. We won't be executing any more women. And I think you can speculate that she ends up being executed through a combination of factors, and one of which is just that the brakes weren't pulled on it. The decision was never taken to reprieve her, even though people are generally expecting it, her, the newspapers are expecting it. And I think within government, it just seems to happen, because no one puts the brake on it. But then for all the other cases of women, they do. And in terms of the profile of those women, she's one woman who's executed and the other 21 are reprieved. So of the 22 women in total, 12 had been convicted for the murder of an infant. So there was no real expectation that they were going to be executed anyway. So they're kind of reprieved as of just expectation. A woman hadn't been executed for that type of offence since the middle of the century before. So then you're ending up with 10 women who have murdered adults. And obviously, out of those, only Annie Walsh is executed. And these are cases where, not all of them, but there's a good few of them, that if the perpetrator had been male, you could put money on the fact that he probably would have been executed. But this kind of mercy by gender starts to take hold, which I suppose is no surprise given the gender roles at the time. But there was a kind of a hefty dose of paternalism whereby it becomes unthinkable to execute a woman, no matter their crimes. And you can see that in those later 1920s crimes and in some of the more heinous crimes committed by women around the time.
Yeah, because some of them are extraordinary. The case of Jane O'Brien, who shot her nephew because he threatened to evict her from the farmhouse. And she's convicted. Mary Agnes Daly, who murdered an 83-year-old woman who was kneeling in prayer in the church. She beat her over the head with a hammer and she was convicted. Frances Cox, who was found guilty after a six-day trial. She put strychnine in drinks prepared for her brother because her brother didn't approve of the marriage that she was making, and she was reprieved 2 weeks before her date with the hangman. Some extraordinary cases.
Yeah, and those cases that you've picked out are at the kind of worst end of the spectrum. The Daly case is kind of a rarity in the group because she's the only person that kills someone who's unknown to her, which in terms of the profiles of killing is much more male. But her context, kind of once you dig into all the context, you do kind of see the class coming out, the precarity of a lot of the women who were sentenced to death. So Mary Daly was in very dire financial straits. And it seems like she'd gone into the church in Dublin with the hammer in her bag, with the intention of just stealing money from the collection box. And she'd seen that Mary Gibbons was there. Mrs. Gibbons was just in praying, and she kind of seized her opportunity, and it ended in a way that she hadn't intended. And that case is incredibly tragic, obviously, but also rare in the fact that Mrs. Gibbons gave a dying declaration in which she said the poor woman was out of her mind. You know, she shouldn't be executed. She should be spared. And the case of Frances Cox as well, another incredibly tragic case. She was arrested for the murder of her brother as she's walking down the steps, basically, of the courthouse after being convicted of the manslaughter of her infant. So she's also coming into this at a period where you could kind of speculate that she's in a deep amount of mental turmoil. She was hoping to marry someone who was of the wrong religion, according to her family. She'd gotten pregnant. She'd killed the baby. And then I think just the concern about what was going to happen her led to her killing her brother. So each of these cases, I think when women are convicted of murder, the cases have a tendency to reflect the profile of women at the time in a way that's not necessarily the case with men.
And are women treated differently when it comes to thinking about capital punishment?
Yeah, very much so. And I know that is really very much on steroids in the Irish case, where it becomes the case that it is unthinkable to hang a woman. But there are kind of multiple, I suppose, jurisdictions, and especially as you kind of come through the centuries, where it just becomes more likely that a woman will be reprieved from sentence of death, but not always. So research on England and Wales, for example, by Annette Ballinger, has shown that absolutely women are more likely to be reprieved. But once you take out the specific crimes, you can see that women who are convicted of the murder of a man are less likely to be reprieved than male murderers. So it's very much depending on who they've killed and the perceived kind of social wrong that's going on.
James Kelly, it's very interesting to look back through the centuries the way Lindsay is suggesting there, because you've written about this, and it's interesting the way there are different even types of seriousness in the way they're described. Some are kind of barbarous murders, some are seen as, you know, more petty treason. There's the high treason, that there's all these kind of different types of descriptions for the seriousness of these crimes.
Well, I think I suspect is first of all a reflection of the fact that, you know, the taking of somebody's life, or more precisely, the commission of an offence that was deemed, which the sanction that was deemed warrantable was execution vary. So then, in which case, you need to have variations. And to some degree, you set yourself a major problem as part of a judicial system if the standard form of response is effectively capital punishment. Because basically, then you've got to try and, well, if you identify and perceive that is the response to all such crimes, well, what do you do when there are obviously some are more aggravating and more aggravated than others, in other words, more serious? The top of the tree, of course, is treason. And it's in that context that you get capital punishment. And famously, that's where people are hanged, drawn and quartered. But the more standard form of execution for men is hanging. And for women in the 18th century is burning. So in that context, you know, what we've been hearing about the debate that was going on in Ireland in the 20th century is interesting. But things have moved on dramatically since the 18th century, when hanging was deemed inappropriate in the case of women. So hence they had the sanction of burning to death, which from our perspective seems even more gruesome. But your point is basically the correct one, is that there's gradations and variations. So if we interpret and perceive execution as a standard and then basically operate in analysing the variations within this, then we can get perspective on it. Moreover, it changes over time. It changes in response to particular crises. And one can identify various moments in which that is the case. I mean, if you go to the end of the 17th, the beginning of the 18th century, when there was a perception in amongst the authorities that the social order was seriously under threat, you know, there were some really, what by latter-day standards, seemed quite outrageous interventions. You know, there was a case in County Clare in 1694, for example, when 13 people were hanged. Now, there were Tories, and in the eyes of the authorities, therefore, effectively, by definition, had lost that right. But move on, pretty much almost a century later, and you find a situation in Dublin in 1782, when, in fact, there is a decision is effectively taken to move execution from being publicly performed, at least publicly performed in the sense that in a specific hanging location, to prisons, which is the beginning of a process which culminates in what we see in the 20th century, when all execution is performed behind walls. So it is a practice which has within it great variation and which changes considerably over the several centuries in which we have a record of how it was applied and implemented.
And it is very significant there what you're saying about the place of execution, because there was this performative aspect to it where they would often have it at the scene of the crime or the place, and they wanted the public to see it and they wanted it to be a spectacle.
Well, see, the crucial point we need to bear in mind is there's almost a general consensus that execution is legitimate. And then the issue that arises within this, how do you actually demonstrate that there are certain sanctions and offences that are much more condign and are much more heinous and that deserve much more severe enforcement? And what you see happening in the middle of the 18th century, quite interestingly, and at least its intensification in the 18th century, is the practice whereby executions are being performed in the locality. You know, our general perception is at Tyburn, and in Irish case, the Tyburn of Dublin was basically close to Stephen's Green. This was the location in which where they caught the hanging tree, as it was sometimes described, was located, and that was the site of execution. In practical terms, crimes occurred and as public outrage in response to crimes intensified, it becomes increasingly a pattern whereby the authorities endeavour to underline and to emphasise their disapprobation of what actually has occurred by having the execution perpetrated at the spot. of the offence. It's also basically born out, I suppose, of a conviction that people in the locality are, if not implicated in it, it's to them that the message of disapproval must be most passionately and most emphatically given to. But it results really in a multiplicity of locations, if you know, aggregated over a period of decades at least, at which executions are perpetrated and affected.
And Kevin, that in a way partly inspired your interest, because there's a place known as Rocket's Tree. Tell us about that.
Well, Rocket's Tree is one of those many local areas where there is a particular place named after somebody who's been executed there. In the case of Rocket's Tree, it's just a place just outside Waterford City, just on the Upper Yellow Road beyond Ballybricken. And it is a place that certainly before 1776, which is the earliest date I've seen reference to it, it was a place where, according to later historians, suggested that it was an outlaw, perhaps a pirate or a robber who was actually hanged there. And now, considering this is only about less than a mile from where the county execution site in Waterford was, on John's Bridge, at one of the gates to the city, was where a great many people, including five white boys, were executed in 1762, that a great many other places throughout the county where there'd been white boy activity, particular crime, a murder happening or the like, and they still carry that name. But even in a lot of other places, like in town centres and the likes, you have Gallows Green, you have Gibbet Hill. There's such a place just outside Waterford as well. But there's two townlands in County Kilkenny that have Gibbet in it. Other places have Hangmans in the townland name and the like. So it was just such countrywide. There were so many of these locations where executions happened locally, not necessarily, as James is saying, in a particular place in the centre of the town, or well before there was, it was within a prison setting. But even in Waterford, when they had executions occurring in the newly built jail from the 1780s onwards, they still kept the site opposite the jail as a public execution site, a place called Mayor's Walk. So they had that option of still retaining a public spectacle, as was often the case.
And it shows by the names that you've mentioned, it shows how quickly it becomes part of the oral history and the folklore, and how these stories survive through the place names and the legends long after the official records fade.
Well, even in the case of the Rocket's Tree story, which is just across the River Shure from South Kilkenny, where Rocket's Castle near Portlaw is still located, originally a Norman settler family from the 13th century, but by the 18th century had become something very different in the post-Cromwellian period. And there was still the folk memory of what happened, probably in the 17th century there, where people were remembering that one of the villains of the particular execution, hung, drawing, quartering, because he'd offended the king, usually identified as Charles I, who, of course, lost his own head in 1649, and the 12th Earl of Ormond. So that within the folk memory, even centuries later, there was still that resonance of what had happened, real or imagined, what happened in earlier centuries.
And James, even the names there, Kevin mentioned the gibbet, and you know, the gibbeting, the hanging in chains, like the types of punishment, you know, going beyond the hanging, the drawing and the quartering, you know, could be quite gruesome, where people could be, the heads could be spiked and severed and put on display, and people could be tortured and mutilated alive due to their crimes. I think you write about the case of Charles Carraher, and there's all these fascinating stories of people who are punished in pretty gruesome and unique ways.
Oh, it's repellent, really. He has the power, even at this remove, to disturb. And the case of Carraher, whom you mentioned, is an illustration of several of the points we've been identifying. In other words, not only is he deemed I won't say outside the law because the law has got him, but basically as a Tory, he effectively...
Now, what do we mean by that, as a Tory?
Oh, sorry, I beg your pardon.
For listeners who might be thinking, God, they're very anti the Conservative Party back then.
Yes. The Tories were basically brigands or bandits, I suppose we might identify them. them, but they have an aura of also reflecting sort of popular resistance to the new social order that was coming into being at the end of the 17th, beginning of the 18th century. And because that largely explains, I would suggest, that the utter severity of the authorities' response to them. And it can be exemplified in a sense by the case of Carahar, or as he was known among his peers, he was Captain Colmore, which suggests that he was a leading figure among a group of what we would describe, or in the words of Eric Hobsbawm, as bandits. And he was, the law already had been strengthened at the end of the 17th century, which effectively denominated anybody who was identified as a Tory, and they were so listed in public proclamations and so on, that effectively if they were captured and tried, effectively the likely outcome was capital punishment. But in the case of Colmore, who was captain, and who was reputedly responsible for 4 murders, I mean, the manner of the effection of his execution really is disturbing. Partly it's a reflection of the fact that it was effected in Dundalk. My reckoning is that the person who was responsible just wasn't skilled at this job, which seems rather disturbing in itself, the idea that you actually, as an executioner, you have a capacity to perform the job skillfully. Because in that instance, when Colmore was half-hanged, as he was, and taken down off the gallows, and they set about the process of quartering his body, effectively it was done in such a crude manner. I mean, it really is shocking. And it's an illustration of a system put in place that's on the extremes. There are going to be moments that effectively, I think, basically undermine the value of the sanction. Because there are later ones in which, in order also to affirm the hostility to the crimes for which people were responsible, bodies were effectively being displayed. You know, there were various manifestations of this. Bodies could be displayed in a gibbet, which basically meant that the hanged body was hanged from a wooden frame. Bodies could be hung in chains, which basically meant the body was put at a particular location, tied up in chains in order to prevent it effectively disintegrating. But that didn't work. And there's a particularly grim case in Dublin in this respect, where basically 4 bodies were hung in chains along the south wall, as it was, and effectively the body started disintegrating, as inevitably they must do, and the smell, as you could imagine, was basically offensive, and the authorities responded by introducing a process of putting bodies in irons on the grounds that they would be more secure. I mean, the mind boggles in a sense in terms of you're conceiving of it, but the point about it all is all predicated on the presumption and assumption that capital punishment is legitimate. And there isn't much until we get to the end of the century, really, of criticism of its merits.
And you mentioned earlier about burning women. Yeah. How frequent was that, or was that considered?
Not frequent. I mean, this is why it is fascinating that the echoes are slightly more remote, as it were, than the points we've just been hearing about the attitude towards the execution of women in Ireland in the 1920s. The perception was that women were less likely to, and statistically, women performed or perpetrated less crimes than men did. But there was also a perception which informed this that there were different forms of execution were more appropriate in the case of women. I mean, without going into any of the unnecessary detail, I mean, if any of us were to find ourselves on a gallows, I mean, the physiological response is not just simply that we die because of loss of access to air, and we die and expire on that basis, but basically the whole body process relaxes and so on. And as you know, it has less edifying manifestations. In the case of women, the perception was that this was entirely inappropriate that it should be done. So whether, and I personally would disagree on this, whether it was desirable that effectively that you burn somebody alternatively, and that was more humane, it seems to be highly problematical. Now, there too, there was commonly averred that what happened in those instances, that the hangman got in and effectively choked the woman first. And then effectively the body was burned, was a dead body rather than the person was burned alive. But, you know, these are distinctions that can be difficult, it seems, to justify, not least in terms of the history as much as retrospectively.
Now, one of the saddest 18th century ones that I've come across is that a woman who had killed her husband and was sentenced to be executed, then they realized that she was pregnant. So it was decided to postpone the execution until after the baby was born.
Yeah.
But a point that also maybe that could be made in terms of the pre-20th century one. In the 1830s, there was a considerable change in who was liable to be executed. Obviously, treason, murder, rape. Yeah. And in the from then on, the numbers dropped quite considerably. There was huge numbers in England and Wales, and considerable numbers still here in the 19th century. But in from the 1830s to the end of the century, there were 227 executed in Ireland, of whom, you might say, only 13 were women. So there was a very considerable awareness, indeed, as James is saying, really about the 18th century, that there was much less likely for women to be executed. But in the case of that 18th century example, that obviously there was, it's not known whether or not she was subsequently executed, or has happened, indeed, as again as James has shown, over 10,000 were transported who had been sentenced to be executed and were sent off to the English colonies and later from the 1780s to Australia, who were just simply transported rather than executed. Because
one can add in that context, I mean, transportation actually was an alternative. Yeah. And in the absence of transportation, then the already high number of people who were executed would have been considerably higher.
Yeah.
And then imprisonment emerges at the end of the 18th, but especially in the 19th century, as the other strand to penal policy.
Well, we're talking history, and tonight we explore and investigate the history of Ireland's non-political executions from the 18th century right up to the 20th. We're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we'll be talking more about the film on the life of Annie Walsh, and we'll also be finding out about colonial and post-colonial attitudes towards crime. Stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about the history of Ireland's non-political executions. Our panel of experts, Professor Kevin Rock, Professor Emeritus of Film Studies at Trinity College Dublin, Dr. Lindsay Black, Associate Professor in the School of Law and Criminology at Maynooth University, Professor James Kelly, Professor of Irish History at DCU, and Matthew Rockett, the writer, director, composer and producer of The Girl from Fetimore, about the execution of Annie Walsh. Matthew, talk to us about the film and how and why you decided to make it in this experimental way, as a way of, I suppose, telling this story in an innovative way.
Sure. So the music was going to be a really big part of the story right from the onset. So there is this theatricality. I mean, it's already been described as this experimental Gaelic Gothic story, film musical, because it has all these aspects. The story is also kind of told through song, ballad, Irish ballad. So I wanted to evoke that maybe 1920s, maybe even earlier, Irishy sound from maybe the West Coast that will be familiar with people. So a lot of the story there's very little dialogue.
And it allows us to explore the idea of the subjectivity of justice and memory and historical perception. Did you see Annie Walsh as a victim or someone who became a victim, even though she began as the perpetrator of this terrible crime?
She's sort of this anti-hero that I kind of, you know, the more you read about her and the more records I dived into, I was like, yikes, this is not looking good. But I certainly think that I wanted to create a bit of a duality. I wanted to show maybe not just her seething rage, maybe at her husband, maybe their relationship wasn't amazing. It wasn't just for the money or for the affair. It was maybe their relationship wasn't superb. So I wanted to show maybe a bit of her own innocence, maybe. And this is something that Lindsay maybe was talking about earlier, about the fact that she had no children, and maybe that was another reason why she was actually executed. There was a lot of women who had those suspended sentences and executions because they had children. And in many of those cases where they had already murdered their husband, that would have left the children with no parents as orphans. So the fact that she didn't. So that is another theme that does play in. Maybe the fact she had wanted a child. And this is something that wasn't in the records, but I just, my own artistic license, I guess, wanted to have it as another facet, that maybe she had wanted a child that the husband wouldn't give her.
And Lindsay, what happened to the women who were found guilty but then not sentenced to death, the sentence of execution not implemented then? What happened? Where did they go?
So this becomes another kind of key part in the story of how the death penalty is deeply gendered and in the Irish post-independence context. So for the 21 women who were spared the hangman, about half of those ended up in some form of confinement beyond the prison. So for men, obviously, if they have their sentence commuted, they go to prison, they spend varying lengths of time there, they spend more time in prison than women do. But then they are released, and they are released absolutely. they may be encouraged to leave the country, but they are released. For women, what happens is, on average, you get the women who are reprieved from death spending less period of time in prison than the men. But then frequently, they are only transferred from prison, only allowed to leave prison on the condition that they enter another institution. And these became institutions like the Magdalen Laundries were very commonly used. In one case of a Protestant woman, it was a mother and baby home. And then Henrietta Street as well, the convent there. And so what seems initially like kind of getting away with it becomes actually, for many of the women, a bit of a life sentence, where the men would have been out and kind of free to go about their lives much more quickly than the women. A lot of the women are in prison for long periods of time or in convents for long periods of time, where in effect it is like a form of social death, because that's them. They're not going to be allowed to leave. For a lot of these women, especially the women that kill their children, there is just a presumption that they're weak-minded. So therefore, you have the rationale coming in that we shouldn't allow these women to leave the convent, so they remain there until their death.
And so it becomes this Irish solution to it of institutionalising the women instead. To what extent does this reflect the broader colonial attitude to justice that went back to the 18th century and before? To what extent do you see kind of some maybe post-colonial thinking about it? And to what extent do you also see the inclusion of some Catholic social values that are then also kind of contributing to attitudes in this independent state?
I think the Irish case is really interesting, and it matches on to other kind of post-colonial contexts. Like in my own research, I've looked at the Caribbean a bit, but coming back to Ireland first to kind of get a sense of what's going on there. There is, I think, an assumption that once a country has attained independence, they get rid of all the oppressive legislation and punishments that were imposed by the colonist. And that's obviously not what happened in the Irish case, and it's not necessarily what happens in many of the cases. So even though they consider, and one of the drafts of the Constitution in 1922 includes the abolition of capital punishment, for reasons pertaining to the state of the country, it is retained. And then even though in the 60s there's partial abolition, capital punishment is still retained for political murders up until 1990. So, which is longer, I suppose, than the European average. So it kind of bucking the trend, because the association of capital punishment at the time of independence, I suppose, would very much have been as a way that the English oppressed the revolutionary heroes of Ireland. But then, sure, it's retained by the same revolutionary heroes and very much for the same purposes. It's retained as something to combat political violence and the IRA in particular. And that's why it's retained right up until 1990, even though no one's been executed for decades at that stage. And then in terms of the kind of Catholic flavour of it, you see this kind of coming in the debates about abolishing capital punishment in Ireland, which starts, I suppose, a decade after independence. But they never really gather up a huge head of steam in the Irish context. And some people have speculated that perhaps that was because there's not enough executions, so you don't get a chance from execution to actually get the momentum gathered. But a lot of the resistance is quite muted. There is not a huge amount of resistance to capital punishment from the Catholic Church at all. It is just quite accepted as the status quo. And occasionally in the debates about abolition, there are references to the fact that Ireland is a Catholic country. So that should inform our abolition. We should abolish because we are Catholic, as opposed to England being the kind of the inference from that. But they don't really. They don't go anywhere. There aren't that many executions, I suppose, but there's not a huge amount of calls for abolition. And I've done a bit of work in the context of the Caribbean and looking at some of the Caribbean jurisdictions. And it is quite similar in that you would expect these laws, these kind of punitive laws, where it said that capital punishment was the only sentence for murder. You would expect those to be repealed pretty quickly after independence. And they're just not. And it becomes kind of, once you get into the 1990s and you have Caribbean jurisdictions that have their ultimate court of appeal as the Privy Council in London, you get this weird kind of counter-colonial thing going on where the court in London is saying, we're not going to strike this down, but you really should abolish. And the Caribbean jurisdiction saying, no, and we don't appreciate the interference from you.
You have the case of Marie Murray, who was condemned to death when she and her husband Noel were found guilty in 1975 for shooting a guard, Michael Reynolds. They had robbed a bank, and that was commuted. I think she's the last woman to be condemned to death in Ireland. But it's only in 1990 that the Criminal Justice Act prohibited capital punishment for all crimes, including treason. And then it's only in 2001 where you have that referendum, the 21st Amendment to the Constitution, where you have this constitutional prohibition on the death penalty and the removal of any references to capital punishment. So it is something within living memory that we see these major changes when it comes to the death penalty and capital punishment.
Yeah, even though it seems like something which is very historical, I mean, that's not that long ago, and Ireland became one of the very few countries, I suppose, that by consensus said, that's it for us in capital punishment. We're taking it out of the statute books. We're removing the ability to put it back on the statute books. And it is very much a case in Europe, I suppose, post-World War II. You have a lot of jurisdictions and they're just going about abolition by degree. They start to commute more than they execute, so it falls into abeyance that way. You start to have de facto abolition in many jurisdictions, and then eventually, after a bit of a gap, that's placed in statute. Ireland, I mean, 1990, again, not that long ago, and even during the debates for the final abolition in 1990, you do have calls that maybe this is what we need, because obviously we're still going through a period of the Troubles in Northern Ireland. There is the spillover, as it's kind of often termed. So there are occasional debates about this. But then at the same time, you have that. You have the miscarriages of justice in the UK relating to kind of very high profile cases where the wrong person was convicted. And if they had been executed, the kind of injustice would be unthinkable. So that's also, in terms of the Troubles, motivating a lot of what the discussion is when it comes to 1990.
And James Kelly, in your work on the death penalty in the 18th century and capital punishment, you also look at miscarriages of justice. And this is something that does pop up every now and then.
Oh, indeed. By definition, any human system is fallible. So there are always going to be cases of the age. And in practical terms, while it's almost impossible to identify at this remove precisely what cases are miscarriages of justice or cases where the judicial system acts too severely, one guide that I've utilised, which echoes what Kevin has been observing apropos of the white boys in County Waterford, are those instances where there is public resistance. Because it's, I think, to my mind, there's a broad societal consensus that capital punishment itself is not the issue. It's not, there's not illegitimate as a response to severe crime or severe transgression. But there are cases on the edge in which people either disagree with the prosecution or fundamentally disagree with the outcome, with the guilty verdict, because they believe a person is innocent. And those are instances in which you can see protests. And the most famous case would be, of course, that of Nicholas Sheedy, who is the priest who was associated with the white boys in County Tipperary, and who was pursued at the behest of a local radical and a sort of a Protestant interest, I would suggest, and he was executed. And the authorities took grave exception to that, not simply because he was a priest, and there would be in a certain respect due to the man because of that, not simply also because of the leadership he provided in the community, because there was a fundamental belief that effectively this is a trumped-up charge.
So it's a judicial murder.
The executor, the hangman, was himself killed four years later.
Yes. That's the most severe manifestation of the public
disapproval. When there was quite clearly it was a trumped up charge against Sheedy by, let's say, the local Protestant interest. And the revenge was taken essentially at the popular level 4 years later.
And it brings home the point that in the 20th century, these cases are rare and they stand out more. But in the 18th century, this was a way of life, a way of death.
Yes, but the other point that struck me very forcefully exploring what was going on in the 18th and continues into parts of the 19th century as well, is that there are some outrageous cases of violence perpetrated by local groups or by individuals upon, the case today, and indeed the cases we're talking about of Annie Walsh. I mean, there are domestic instances in which families just break down, and somebody basically, whether because they're sociopaths or because they just lose it effectively and strike out violently and kill a result for multiple deaths. They really test any system. And I would be a bit loath to assume, for example, in the system of which we are a part, notwithstanding constitutional amendments, that there won't be calls again in the future for exemplary punishments in instances where offences are perpetrated that are seen to push the societal norms. I mean, infanticide is one which for a time was regarded as such, and women were executed for infanticide by burning. In 1790, they changed that, and effectively women were to be hanged. But this coincided with the point in time in which also there was a greater societal, or willingness societally, to accept that infanticide wasn't a normal crime, and that the courts then begin effectively looking for ways in which not to apply or issue a capital verdicts. But then effectively what they had the option at that stage, and effectively usually people were just transported as a consequence. So you could basically move them out of the community.
Well, we're talking history, and tonight we're talking about the history of Ireland's non-political executions. And when we come back, we'll be talking about the legacy, the lessons, and the impact of these executions. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about the history of Ireland's non-political executions. Rejoined by Professor Kevin Rockett of Trinity College Dublin, Dr. Lindsay Black of Maynooth University, Professor James Kelly of DCU, and Matthew Rockett, the writer, director, composer, and producer of The Girl from Fenimore, about the execution of Annie Walsh. Matthew, I'm curious to know how people have responded to your film. I wonder what's the reaction been like in Ireland, and what's been the reaction outside of Ireland?
Sure. So at the moment, it's doing quite a healthy festival circuit. It's been officially selected for and nominated for Cannes Independent Awards and Best Musical at Monza Film Festival. So interestingly, it's doing quite well at the international audiences, like Central Europe and the US. They're quite intrigued by the story and maybe how I'm telling it. Interestingly, it's not so popular here. I think maybe it's a bit too close to home, maybe on the nose, maybe. I'm not sure. I think it maybe would scare a few people of actually what some of our violent history is really like. But yeah, I just wanted to say that I was really thankful to be able to make it, and I had a really small crew. I worked with my girlfriend, who's the co-producer and lead actress of Annie.
We'll have to name her.
Bláthnaid Saville, she's an absolute star. And then the other two, we had Alex Mulcahy playing the murdered husband, and Joseph Byrne, who was playing the nephew.
And are you interested in continuing with these kinds of historical reflective films, or something different next time out?
I think it's something that's possibly on the cards, whether it's a film, a short film, or maybe even a live theatre musical production, something maybe with the maybe around 1981 with the hunger strikes or something, kind of another portion of history that would be an interesting perspective.
Lindsay, I'm thinking that this year in August the 6th is the 250th anniversary of the birth of Daniel O'Connell, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of stuff around that. The day before August the 5th is the centenary of the death of Annie Walsh, the execution of Annie Walsh. It probably won't be marked, and it probably should be marked.
I think yes. I mean, it is largely forgotten now. Although it occasionally crops up in kind of newspaper articles that mention her and mention it. But it did, for the cases that came after her, it very much became a touchstone for those women and for those women's legal teams. Because for the cases that came after, they had to do everything they could to distinguish their client from the Annie Walsh of 1925, who ended up being hanged in Mountjoy Prison in Dublin. So I think it's worth delving into the history of it, and I think it's worth kind of delving in to that kind of deeply gendered aspect of capital punishment, which kind of tells the story of post-independence Ireland.
And by commemorating and by remembering what happened, we're not endorsing the murder, but we're just making a point about capital punishment and the effects and the impact that it has on a society.
Yeah, I think the social history aspect is one of the kind of key things which you can bring out from cases of crime and punishment historically. very few people leave anything in terms of a trace of them in the records. It's only whenever it comes to people who are before the courts as victims or as the criminals that we can kind of see the day-to-day lives of ordinary people, which is what Annie Walsh was, despite how she ended up. So I think it's important to kind of commemorate it in that regard as kind of a piece of social history, which tells us something about the time.
James Kelly, what really stood out in your work on the 18th century was just how the 18th century was going along with various executions and punishments and the death penalty being implemented. But then suddenly you hit the 1790s and everything seems to go off the rails, and it just seems to be an incredibly brutal, bloody decade where violence becomes the norm.
Well, the object of any historian is to try to identify patterns in the past. And partly, just before I get to that, just to address the final response, the reason why it's important we keep cases like Annie Walsh in our mind's eye is that it encourages to actually explore the principles upon which our criminal justice system is based. Now, your point about the 18th century is pertinent here, in that 1770s and 1780s, there were signs that the authorities were beginning to look at alternatives to the ready resort to capital punishment, to put it like that. So you get the beginnings of construction of prisons. There's a prohibition during the American War on transportation. Now it's given a lease of life once Australia comes onto the equation. But in the Irish context, such signs as you see with the Inspector of Prison, who's really producing critical reports of the system, the likelihood of that actually developing are diminished once society basically becomes subject to insurgency in the 1790s, because the authorities respond in quite a condign and enforceful fashion. And I don't think it's an accident that you see an increase in the tendency for not only for people to be executed, but for basically them to be decapitated and their heads to be put on spikes. There was less reliance on the gibbet in this instance. And I personally, I'm of the view that for a generation slows down any prospect. Now, I can't stop the tide, as it were, of history. And while I'm not advocating or suggesting that in the criminal justice system, we're talking about a progress from an era of barbarousness into an era of comparative or relative civility, as it were. The trends and tendency we see in the 19th century of the state to take more and more role means more and more of that execution is one put behind walls, and then slowly but imperceptibly at times but inevitably is moving to a situation where it becomes the norm, becomes exceptional.
And James, do you think it's important that we do remember and mark the anniversary, the centenary of the execution of Annie Walsh?
Yes, because fundamentally, I don't think there's sufficient amount of investigation into the nature of our criminal justice system and the principles on which it's predicated. And we've moved from an era in which capital punishment was normative to an era in which incarceration became the norm. But incarceration was justified on the basis that it came with rehabilitative interventions. Now, they have been shown not to be as effective, at least because of the demands of resources and so on. The demand of resources always exceed the scale of the problem. But it means that we need, particularly this moment when there are trends globally that one sees, you know, there are certain countries in which the amount of execution is taking place is still disturbingly high, that we just need to be alert to the basis on which we fix our criminal justice system and place it and see how it evolves, because we're really, if incarceration is not the practice, what else do we do?
Kevin, I'm going to leave the final word with you. It really shows how you can start with one case like that of Annie Walsh, and by opening it up, you really see an awful lot about views of justice, of views towards people and punishment, and how society evolves and changes and sometimes doesn't change quite quickly enough.
Yes, that is true, but everything is political. Even to go back to the original high treason, petty treason, and it's the killing of one's superior. In the case of petty treason, it was the killing, say, of a wife of a husband or a curate of a rector and the like. So it's all ultimately political in the way it's all sort of framed. And in that sort of sense, that we cannot really escape the fact that the laws, whether in the criminal or in the civil or in the treasonous world, are all ultimately political.
Well, I think that's a very powerful note on which to end our discussion tonight. Over the history of Talking History, we have had husband and wife combinations before, but this is our first father and son combination. So it's been an absolute pleasure having you both on, as well as Dr. Lindsay Black and Professor James Kelly. My thanks to my brilliant panel of experts, Professor Kevin Rockett, Professor Emeritus of Film Studies at Trinity College Dublin, Dr. Lindsay Black, Associate Professor in the School of Law and Criminology at Maynooth University and a Council Member of the Irish Legal History Society, Professor James Kelly, Professor of Irish History at DCU, and Matthew Rockett, the writer, director, composer and producer of that short debut film, The Girl from Fenimore. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marisa Sullivan, and Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.